Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Josh Duty. He is a salary negotiation coach and author of Fearless Salary Negotiation. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, Jen. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm super excited to chat. So let's dive in right away with the title of your book, Fearless Salary Negotiation. Why fearless? What's so scary about money?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think I went with fearless because it's easier to just acknowledge the elephant in the room right away, which is that people are generally sort of afraid specifically of negotiation. I think money, some people are afraid of it. Some people like it. Some people don't understand it. But when it comes to negotiation, people are definitely afraid. And they're afraid that if I negotiate, what if they retract the offer? What if they think I'm greedy? What if I make my future hiring manager mad at me before I even start? And so there's a lot of these sort of fears that are mostly kind of we create them ourselves as candidates, as people who want to get jobs. And so I wanted to open with the first word being fearless, saying essentially, listen, first of all, I acknowledge that you have this fear. Secondly, I will show you how to overcome the fear with a process that you can follow. And so that was my idea was, let's just acknowledge it. We'll say this is happening. This is a thing that people experience. And then we're going to talk about how to overcome it to get paid what you're worth.
Yeah. And it really does make it. It definitely resonated with me, you know, because it's like, even for those of us who, you know, have started our own businesses, have some experience with this stuff, there's always that little, the butterflies in the stomach that, oh, what if I say something wrong? I totally don't want to screw this up. And I think it's great to just acknowledge it. But then also, like you said, you know, we kind of create these ourselves. We create these fears ourselves. It's kind of sort of like these stories that we tell ourselves. So have you found that most of the time, or maybe it's all of the time, that these fears are pretty much unfounded and it's just our brain kind of saying, danger, Will Robinson, danger, when there's really nothing to be scared of?
Yes, that's what I found. Almost always that's the case, especially when I think it's pretty enlightening for folks, like especially when I coach people. You know, we'll talk through, you know, specific scenarios that they can anticipate. So they'll say, I have this call tomorrow. What's going to happen on this call? And most of the time I can sort of predict the future and tell them exactly what that call is going to be like. And they go, maybe this isn't as sort of, you know, ad hoc and scary as I thought. Maybe there's actually a process that I just don't have much exposure to. And so I think that people realize as they get more reps and they get more negotiation experience that what they're actually dealing with is their own fear of the unknown as they negotiate against people who are professionals at this. You know, recruiters and hiring managers do this every day. So I tell my clients, listen, before your call that you're going to have with them later where you'll negotiate, they're going to have another call with somebody else and they're going to negotiate with them. And then they're going to hang up with you and then they're going to have another call with somebody else and negotiate with them. They do this all day as professionals. And so when you negotiate with them, they're not thinking, you know, unbelievable, I can't believe this person's negotiating. They're thinking, I'm doing my job. This person negotiated with me. So it's a perspective. It's an understanding what the other side of the table is actually like and what they're experiencing, what their job is.
Right. And even just putting it out there that, look, this person probably had one call, two calls, three calls plus before you where they're negotiating. And actually, they're expecting you to negotiate. That if
exactly.
You don't, then it's going to, yeah, maybe then that might come off as a little weird or at least a little bit unexpected. But where a lot of people do go into it, and I know I have in the past, especially when I first started out, like, oh, like, are they, if I negotiate, you know, like, what's going to happen? Are they going to know how to deal with this? Am I going to know how to deal? And it's almost comforting to know that they've done this. They know it. They got your back, right? In other words, it doesn't have to be seen as like this competition. It's like, look, I've done this before. Let me guide through this process. I'm going to ask you these questions. And it does take away that fear of the unknown.
Yeah. And I like something that you just said, which is, you know, that it's not a competition. So I like to use one word that I use a lot when I coach people and when I talk, you know, even in conversations like this is collaborative or collaboration.
Yeah.
Either when you're negotiating a new job offer and trying to figure out, you know, what are the best terms for me and for this company for me to come do this work for them, or if you're asking for a raise, I see it as a collaboration. And so something that I think my clients are surprised by is that, you know, I tell them, look, you're not going in and like pounding your fist on the desk and making demands. Like, this isn't a movie, right? It's a collaboration where you're having a conversation about what's the value of the work that I'm going to do for your company. can we find a salary or a compensation package that we both feel equally is reflective of that value that I bring? And we start thinking about it that way. It's a lot different than, you know, you're not trying to extract money for them and they're not trying to extract work from you. You're just trying to find a deal that works with a price that works for, you know, the knowledge and the experience that you bring.
That's right. That's right. And you mentioned earlier about being able to predict the future just because you have experience with this stuff and you've coached people through this stuff. And I'm going to take a wild guess that you've gone through negotiation yourself probably many, many times. And so that there is this process. And can you think of another example of what you mean by predicting the future? Like the first one that you gave, just basically around they're going to expect you to negotiate. They have a process here. This is probably how it's going to go. But just so we can wrap our heads around this a little bit more, what else do you mean by predicting the future? Can you think of another example there where it's really kind of, oh, light bulb moment for a client that you've helped?
I think it's a really small one, but this is one that always kind of surprises clients is, you know, the first phase of what we do is figuring out how much are we going to counteroffer? You know, what's the right counteroffer for your situation? And in my book, I have some, you know, kind of a little algorithm that you can use to figure out what that, you know, could be. But, you know, as I work with clients individually, we can usually dial in a little bit more and say, well, based on information that you can give me, which I can't, you know, reflect back to you on the pages of a book, here's what I think is the right counteroffer for you. And so we'll spend a lot of time crafting the actual number for the counteroffer and writing an email to send that counteroffer and make a case and all this good stuff. And they'll say, okay, what happens next? And I'll say, almost certainly within about 12 hours of when you send this email, you're going to get an email or a phone call or a voicemail. And they're going to say, hey, we got your response to our job offer. Thanks for considering it. Do you have some time to talk?
Yep.
And that's almost always them setting up a very short call. And that short call is actually what most people, I think, imagine when they think of salary negotiation, which is a sort of, you know, we said this, you said this, we'd be comfortable here. What do you think about that? And you kind of go back and forth in like literally a 2 or 3 or 4 minute call and it's over. And so they're always surprised that I tell them that and they're thinking what they're expecting. I think a lot of times they're going to send this counteroffer and they're never going to hear from the company again, or they're going to get like a nasty grand back from the CEO or something. and instead, they just get the same email from the hiring manager recruiter and they say, hey, you know, thanks for considering this. Do you have some time to talk? And then they set up a call and it's a 5 minute call. So that's the one that surprises them the most is that inevitably, you know, it's like probably 90% of the time, the response to a counteroffer email is, do you have some time to talk?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love talking about process and, you know, what's the process and nitty gritty details of what goes into, what are the algorithms that go into salary negotiation and the step-by-step process and stuff like that. And we'll get to that a little bit more later. But also before I forget, I want to just give you a chance, Josh, where can people find your content in the stuff and, you know, how you help folks? So you have the book and it's on Amazon, right?
Yes. So you can buy, my paperback is on Amazon. And then the place where you can find most of my content, and I'll say right away, I have a tendency to kind of give away everything for free, meaning that if you want to learn about a topic around salary negotiation, if you go to fearlesssalarynegotiation.com, there are tons and tons of articles, and I tend to write very long, very detailed articles that are deep dives. So fearlesssalarynegotiation.com is where I write my articles, also where you can buy my ebook and some video courses that I have and some other courses, apply for coaching and all that good stuff. It all lives at fearlesssalarynegotiation.com.
Great. Yeah. And I recommend everybody who's listening to just check out fearlesssalarynegotiation.com because there's some really, really great stuff there that especially, it tickled my inner geek, you know, because it's like, ooh, I love process. You know, we love systems and processes. And so where I want to go now, Josh, is to actually talk about who it is that your clients are. So you serve software developers. And so is it exclusively software developers or are there other folks in the mix there too? I'm curious about that, but also why you landed on them as the clients you chose to serve.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. So when I wrote my book, I wasn't writing a book for software developers, but I always tell people, and I think you said you noticed this with process. If you read my book or even read anything that I write, you can see pretty clearly that, you know, there's an engineer behind the stuff that's written here. There's a structure, there's a process, there's algorithms. And that's not to say that it's intimidating for people who are not engineers, but the way that I approach writing and teaching is very methodical, step by step. And so I began with the book not really thinking this is for software engineers or this is for, you know, everybody. I just kind of thought this is the process for negotiating salaries for most companies that are going to offer you a job as a W-2 employee. So I'll write about that. I began working with software developers. One reason is that I am a software developer. I studied computer and electrical engineering in college, and worked as an electrical engineer and then worked for a software company as a project manager and did a little product design and stuff like that. And I built web apps. And so I am a software developer and I understand software developers. And I think that they have a very unique situation in that there's a huge demand for software developers right now. Most people who kind of self-select into software development as a profession are more interested in solving hard technical problems than they are in solving hard social problems. And so they're interested in, you know, having a really great GitHub profile or creating a cool portfolio, not as interested in kind of learning the nuances of how to navigate a salary negotiation or even a job interview. I think a lot of times software developers would like for their work to speak for itself, which would be great if that's how the world operated, but unfortunately it just doesn't. And so I found that there's a lot of opportunity here. I understand software developers because I am one. And I think that there's a big gap sometimes in how hard they fight for their own salary and their compensation versus what's available to them if they just fight for it. And so that's where I said, well, I'm gonna focus on coaching software developers because I think there's a big sort of arbitrage opportunity there for them that I can help them to uncover by using my process and by understanding their situation. And just by having experience negotiating with software companies and, you know, big companies like Google and Facebook, I know how they operate. And so, you know, eventually I built up expertise working with those specific companies. You asked if I only work with software developers. So no, I don't only work with software developers. So that's an interesting thing about kind of hanging out my shingle and saying I'm a software developer salary negotiation coach is a lot of people reach out and say, I know that you work with software developers, but will you work with me? I'm a marketing director. And I say, sure. Yeah. You know, and I have an application process and a vetting process to make sure I think the value is right for them to hire me. But yeah, I work with a lot of non-software developers. And most recently, I found a very interesting niche that I'm starting to work with more and more, which is graduating emergency medicine residents. So doctors.
How super specific. I love it.
I just happened to have a bunch of know a bunch of people and friends who are graduating. And I kept hearing them say over lunch or dinner, yeah, you know, I got this offer from such and such hospital. And, you know, I know that the offers aren't negotiable, but, you know, it's a good offer. And raised my eyebrow and said, not negotiable, huh? Let's tell me more, you know, and I find out that not only are they negotiable, but they are very negotiable. There's a lot of money that can be made through, you know, a clever negotiation. So that's an interesting kind of little side quest that I'm on right now is coaching doctors.
Interesting. So these are folks, they're ER docs here. They just finished their residency. And so they're looking for that first job out of residency and they've maybe gotten an offer.
Yes. Typically what happens is they get lots of offers. So there's a huge demand right now for, I think doctors in general, but emergency medicine is, it's a very difficult field to perform well in. And so these folks are not just getting a single offer. They're getting 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 offers. So they have to navigate, how do I compare these offers? Because they're all special snowflakes, each offer is. They're not like your typical W-2, you know, salary, signing bonus, stock options type offers.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of, you know, difficult kind of mental heavy lifting that needs to be done to even understand each individual offer and help them negotiate the best way for each offer and then compare the offers and all that good stuff. But yeah, they're graduating, they're finishing the residency, getting that first contract is what their goal is. And of course, they think like most W-2 employees, I can't negotiate. I'm brand new here. I don't have any leverage, right? And so I can't negotiate this first contract, but they sure can because of the demand. It's similar to software developers. This is an industry where there's a huge demand for their skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to bring up is that, as you mentioned earlier, Josh, there is a huge demand for software developers right now. And that gives especially experienced software developers, but even new ones, a lot of leverage in terms of saying, look, I have this skill set. This is something that can absolutely add value to your organization. Let's talk. And so in the folks who you've worked with and just in your general sense of what's going on right now in the job market for software development, do you work with lots of people? Do you know lots of people who have multiple offers? Like, is that something that's similar to the ER docs, or is it kind of different?
It's different. Gosh, I haven't really thought of this. How many offers do most of my clients have? I would say I'm going to use the wrong statistical term here. I think it's the mean is like over one and less than two. So, a lot of people have a single offer. Some people have, three or four offers. A number of people will have like two offers. And so it's probably like, the mean is like 1.2 or 1.3, if I had to guess. It's pretty narrow. A lot of times they'll just have the one offer. So they finished up, they interviewed at, some big company, and now they feel like they're getting an offer imminently. And there's this moment, which I can actually see in the traffic on my website to certain pages, where people all of a sudden kind of panic and realize like, oh no, I'm about to get a job offer and I don't know what to do about that. Should I negotiate it? How do I, And so they kind of come and say, I've been talking to Amazon and they're going to make me an offer and I don't know what to do. Can you help? Which is different than like the doctor's side where they're, like I said, they're getting, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 offers pretty routinely. So it's one or two offers typically for the people that I work with.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's good to know. Just in terms of what people can expect, if there are software developers out there listening, they're like, oh, can I expect to get 5 offers? That's been my experience too, but you definitely have your finger more on the pulse of this. And that makes sense that most people it's one. Like that would be the mood, okay? That's the most frequent thing, right?
Yeah.
But then you also get folks who sometimes have a little slightly more than one offer, but it's really going to be, okay, here's the offer. And it actually reminds me of something one of my mentors once told me when I was on the job market years and years ago. It's like, well, I only have this one offer. She's like, you only need one job, Jen. That totally makes sense. You don't need 5 jobs. Like, would you want 5 jobs? So of course there is that sort of that choice thing, like, oh, I wish I could choose. But hey, if it's one offer and it seems like a really, really good fit, then let's increase the chances of you getting it and getting paid what you're worth for it.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot to be said for, this is something that I really deeply understand, which is if you do only have one offer, you are very reticent to do anything that you feel might jeopardize that offer. And so that's, I think, going back to your first question about the word fearless in my book, I mean, I think that's a big fear for people is, I did all this work, I went through school, or I've got this career that I built, and I've been looking for this other job, and I have this one job offer, and it's a special job offer, and I don't want to lose it. I'm afraid that if I negotiate, I'll lose it. And so in that case where you just have that one offer, it's very easy to make sort of bigger picture, longer term mistakes in terms of being, well underpaid, because you're so risk averse and you don't want to try and maximize the value of that offer, but instead just want to protect the offer itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very easy to settle in those situations and sort of lose hope and think that there's not going to be another one down the line. When
yes.
there usually is, because hey, if it doesn't work out, then that's cool. It's not cool. It's unfortunate, but there's going to be another. If one company wants to hire you, most likely it's another company's going to want to hire you too. It's only a matter of time. But that can be really hard to deal with when you're in that moment.
Yes, it definitely is.
So I have sort of a philosophical question, because as you probably know, and some of my listeners probably know, I'm a tech leadership coach. So the folks who I serve are the folks who are usually used to be software developers, and now they're managers, and now they're managers and leaders. But very similar upbringing, very similar approach to the world in terms of being methodical and being wanting to grasp onto systems and all of that cool geeky stuff. So I wonder, the philosophical question is, what is it about, this realm, being an engineer, being, the scientist mind, the data analysis mind, whatever, you might connect with the most, that kind of attracts people to this, that then makes them, I would say us, I used to be a data analysis girl, kind of averse to negotiation, averse to self-promotion. I've always found it fascinating that it's almost like these two different worlds that are clashing and colliding with one another.
Yeah, it is a really interesting phenomenon. And so the first thing that came to mind while you were saying that for some reason is that I don't, it's not never, but rarely do I get people reaching out for help who are, for example, in sales. And I think that's because salespeople are comfortable selling themselves and they're comfortable with self-promotion and they understand that it's a necessary component to finding good jobs and being a sort of in demand and being a desirable person for a sales team. And so because that's also literally their day job is to sell things. And so they can also kind of sell themselves.
Right.
Whereas software developers, that is kind of the opposite of what they do. I mean, a lot of times the software developer's job is sort of buried, you know, multiple levels behind that sales function in most organizations. You know, software developers are very rarely even tangentially involved in the sales process unless they move into like a solutions architect sort of role or something like that, or sometimes business analysis. But for the most part, they're just kind of behind the scenes, you know, writing code and doing whatever project is on their plate right now. And so I think that's a big reason, is that they're so far removed in their career, their job function doesn't look at all like negotiating a salary or selling something. It looks like being a productive person who, you know, writes lines of code or, you know, has a, you know, X number of pull requests or commits on GitHub or however they measure their progress. So I think what it is, and also, by the way, there's no training for that in software developers education either. You know, right. Like I said, I studied engineering. I never took, you know, any business classes undergrad, and certainly not a negotiation class or a sales class or anything that would have prepared me for the idea that it's okay to talk about the benefits of your work and what you can bring to an organization and position yourself as a useful asset to them. It's just never in front of software developers. It's not something they're ever taught or that they're even really exposed to. So I think that's the biggest reason, is it's just not a tool that they have in their toolbox because it never comes up for them.
Yeah. It's what's your world. If your world every day is writing code and building things and shipping products, like, that's your world. And it's like, yeah, sales, they have their thing over here, but I'm super focused. I want to be, you know, almost to the point of obsessed with doing great at my world. And it's just, oh, wow, yeah, I get there's other stuff out there. But, you know, and then it's the folks who are like, you know what, I need some help with that. that would be, you know, the most likely to say reach out and like hire a coach like yourself. That's like the, all right, I get that there's something else out there that I was never taught. And I get that maybe I've made some mistakes in the past. And so here's how I can do better next time and not leave money on the table.
You said something that's really interesting, and kind of the way that you said it, I think I want to call out, which is, I think if we went back and looked at the transcript of like the last two paragraphs that you spoke, I think all of the, oh, I'm going to get these wrong, let's say pronouns were like first person pronouns, I, my, right? And I think that is the biggest difference I see with like engineers and non-engineers is, I don't even think this is on my site anywhere, but sometimes somebody will reach out for salary negotiation coaching and I'll realize that their issue is not that they need to negotiate a salary. It's that they're not getting callbacks on their interviews and they're not getting job offers when they do interview. So they've gotten really good at putting together a really strong resume or portfolio, GitHub profile. They're able to reach out to good companies with good opportunities. They're able to get their resume considered. They're even often able to get that first interview and then nothing happens and they can't figure out why. And it's because I think of that I versus you mentality, which again is something that software developers sort of learn over time, which is, you know, it's all about my project and my code and my abilities and my resume. And what they don't realize is that when somebody's hiring somebody, what they're looking for is in the interview is not for you to, you know, recite your resume to them and they have your resume. Uh-huh. What they're looking for is, you know, I'm trying to solve a problem here. I need to hire an engineer to do X, or I need to hire an engineer to reach this goal, or I'm, you know, need to hire an engineer to overcome this challenge that we're experiencing in our business right now. Sometimes that challenge is we can't ship fast enough. Sometimes it's we're missing this skill set. We don't have a JavaScript developer, and that's a problem for us because we have a lot of front end interactions that need to happen, or whatever it is. And so your job is not to say, you know, here's what's on my resume, here's my portfolio. Your job is to say, you need to hire an experienced JavaScript developer for front end interactions because your UI is stale and people are not able to navigate your site well and purchase stuff from your e-commerce store. Mm-hmm. I can do that because I have experience specifically working in e-commerce with JavaScript on the front end, making better UI, right? And so then the hiring manager says, oh, wow, you're talking about me and my problems and my needs and what I need and why I'm hiring somebody. I'm interested in talking to you more, as opposed to you telling them, you know, basically reciting your resume to them. So that's the big shift. And back to the sales question that you asked earlier. And then this too, I think that's the big thing that I often have to work with folks on the front end and to shift their mindset to, I call it positioning, but you need to describe to them how you're going to help them achieve their goals and overcome their challenges. And when you do that, you will get more interviews and more job offers.
Yeah. And that's central to having it be a collaborative kind of conversation as opposed to a competitive me versus you conversation.
Yes. Yes. Yep.
Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about process now. And so let's do like a top three. So if you were to think about the top three salary negotiation mistakes, or even just hurdles or challenges, however you want to frame them, that you see your clients or software developers making, what would those top three be? So that would be like the first part of the question. And then we could also talk about how would we fix them? How would we overcome those challenges?
Okay, so we'll list them and then we'll come back and talk about how to overcome them.
Sounds good.
Okay, so the first one is, I call it the dreaded salary question as a shorthand, but it's disclosing either your salary history or your current salary or your salary expectations when asked for it. Typically that happens really early in the interview process, and it will be, you know, hiring manager, recruiter. Maybe they're doing a screening call with you and they'll say, oh, by the way, what's your current salary? And what were you hoping to make if you come on board with us? Mm-hmm. So disclosing that information is a mistake. There's a little asterisk there now, which is that some states are now essentially making it illegal for companies to ask for your salary history, which my feelings on the efficacy of that legislation are sort of, you know, neither here nor there. However, mm-hmm. I support it because I tell people not to share that information anyway. Mm-hmm. So it harms them. So that's number one. Yeah. The second one, let's see, I'm trying to do these kind of, I want to make sure they make sense. So the first one is sharing that information. I'd say the second one is not negotiating at all, which sounds kind of like a cop-out, I guess. But mm-hmm. One of my biggest jobs as a coach sometimes, even when people have hired me and paid me my fee, which is I priced it so that people that are really serious about negotiating a good job offer work with me. Yep. Even then, I sometimes have to coach them to negotiate. They get cold feet and they're like, I don't know. Like, what if they pull this offer? And I say, listen, you have to trust me on this, that I know what I'm doing. And if we do this together, you're going to be fine. But they, you know, and I know that if people are paying me my fee and working with me and they're still getting cold feet and considering not negotiating,
yeah.
that people who don't work with me are way too often, they're just not even negotiating. They're just accepting it. I think that's a big mistake. Mm-hmm. And I think the third one would be, it's really hard to get people to send a counteroffer, which is sort of the first real negotiation thing that looks like a negotiation. And because it's so hard to get them to do that, that often they will send that counteroffer, they'll let their guard down and will say, I did it, I negotiated. And then what they don't realize is what's coming right behind that is that phone call that I mentioned where they respond to your counteroffer. And there's often a lot of, you know, sometimes marginal, but sometimes better than marginal gains that you can get by kind of keeping that negotiation hat on and negotiating all the way through to the end of the process until you have decided yes or no, I'm going to work for them. So those are the three: is disclosing salary history or salary expectations, not even negotiating, and then letting your foot off the gas too quickly after you send a counteroffer and not seeing the negotiation through to the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So let's take these one by one in terms of how to approach them more effectively so that we can get the job we want and not leave yes. any money on the table and get paid what we're worth and conquer that fear. So the dreaded salary negotiation question, the what is your salary history? What are your expectations around salary? So I guess number one here would be if you do live in one of those states where it's not legal anymore to ask that question, I would say, you know, do your homework and stay on top of that, especially if you're on the job market and maybe even moving across states that have that, be armed with that information, because it's probably possible that some employers who are hiring don't know that legislation exists or that it is about to exist.
Yes. Yeah, I think you want to be on top of the two that come to mind. And I by the way, I'm not sure this is accurate, but I think California and New Jersey have done that. New York may also have done it. So there aren't that many, and it is possible that it's so new, or maybe even the legislation hasn't actually been signed into law yet, so that, you know, the HR may not know. I would think it behooves companies to know that sort of thing, and they're probably very careful about it. However, you may run into a situation where they're asking you and they shouldn't be.
Yeah. But let's say somebody lives in one of these states where it's not yet law. And it comes to the point where maybe it's an HR person, for example, who said, okay, I have this form. I need to put your salary, your past salary. I need to know. How would you suggest responding to that?
I like the example you gave there because it's so common. It's like, I'm not asking you for the salary. The form is asking you.
Yep,
exactly. Which is like, okay, you kind of roll your eyes. So there, I break this into two parts. By the way, I think this might be the longest article on my site is on this exact question because it's so common. So I'll make sure after we talk, I'll send you a link to it so you can review it and maybe include it in the show notes if you want to do that.
Absolutely.
So I break it into two parts. One is the salary history or current salary question. The other one is the expected salary question. The kind of all-encompassing answer is I'm not comfortable discussing my salary. I prefer to focus on the value that I bring to your organization and to your position. I want this move to be a big step forward for me in both responsibility and compensation, and I look forward to talking to you further. Mm-hmm. And so you're doing – it's interesting because a lot of the stuff that I write, it looks like I just kind of threw that on paper, but really this is stuff that I think deeply about. And what you want to do in this kind of situation is they're asking you for information. You feel like you should give them that information, and you feel like if you withhold it that you might be damaging your prospects. And so what you want to do is answer in a way where you – don't give them that information. That's number one with a bullet. But then after that is, well, how do I withhold information in a way that also allows me to continue moving the narrative forward that I'm going to focus on adding value to them? So that's really what's going on in that answer is you're saying, I don't want to share that, but I do want you to know that I'm focused on value that I can add to your company. I want to understand that better. I want to understand the role better. And so that's the way that I like to approach it is to not just say no, but to say, I would rather focus on this and kind of reframe it and redirect the conversation.
Yep. And this goes back to the, this is us together. It's not just I, this is you and me. We're collaborating here. Isn't this what you want too? Right. Let's keep our eye on the prize here. And then, you know, I would say most people, or I don't know how people would react, honestly. I would say that, you know, let's say hypothetical HR person might say, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I can just leave it blank or I'll just put something. Or I've actually read, you basically, how about we just put zero? Let's put something. Mm-hmm. Let's put zero. You have to put something in this form. All right. Let's put $0. But, you know, and then I prefer that we focus on, you know, what value can I add? How can I help? And how can we move this conversation forward? But it is a place where people get stuck often. And like, it's a fear. I think it's like, what do I say? Because it's like, oh, I've had friends who have gone here and then, oh, they just sort of spilled the beans. Yep. I made whatever X amount at my previous job. And you're totally compromising your negotiation position by doing that. So it's basically saying, no, I'm not going to let you do that, but I still want to move. I'm not going to be a jerk here. I still want to move this conversation forward. So.
Yeah. It's really interesting. So the reason I think this is a big mistake is that there's so much going on here. First of all, it's very sneaky. Because I constantly kind of waffle. For example, I have a salary negotiation guide on my site that's like a top to bottom, here's what salary negotiation looks like. Mm-hmm. In that guide is this question, even though the dreaded salary question, even though it typically comes up in the interviews, it's technically not part of the negotiation. There is no job offer on the table yet.
Right.
But it's sneaky because it comes up so early that as a candidate, your mindset is, what do I have to say to continue getting interviews so that I have a shot at getting a job offer? Mm. And so a lot of times people don't even register it as a salary negotiation question. They register it as essentially just a gatekeeper interview question that they answer and then they move on. What they don't realize is they're filing that number away and you've actually kind of pre-negotiated to set a baseline for your salary negotiation or even a ceiling. And so it's very sneaky in that way. And it'll catch people off guard. So, you know, also, like I said, it's a gatekeeper type question. So it's perceived as an interview question when it's actually a very early stage salary negotiation question that's filed away. Mm-hmm. So this is why I put it as the number one mistake, because there are so many ways that it can kind of trip you up.
Yep.
And it's not a coincidence. This happens all the time where somebody will reach out and say, well, you know, I told them I'm making $95,000 and they offered me $100,000 and I'm like, I could have told you they were going to offer you $100,000 before you told me they did, because they take your current salary, they add like a point or two, and then that's your new salary. That's how they do it. So, and the only time really that you will get around that is if your current salary that you've disclosed to them is so low that they cannot pay you that salary and still be within the pay bands or pay structure of their company. And so they'll actually offer you quite a bit more money than your current salary, which you feel like is a huge win. Mm-hmm. Reality is they're offering you the absolute minimum they can offer you to employ you in that job within their structure. So yep. it's just sneaky all the way around. There's tons of little hidden traps in that question that are just not obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So good to be aware of it. So yes. that's number one. Number two, not negotiating at all. And I have some personal experience with this. When my husband was on the job market for the first time for one of his first jobs right out of college. And we were together at that point. And I remember it was more money than either of us had ever made in a year. You know, it was like double that. And we were like, oh, cool. And he just went back and said, yeah, awesome. And we'll take mm-hmm. it. You know, when can I start? He didn't negotiate at all. And then the recruiter who was helping us, he was an internal recruiter who worked for the company he worked for, we got to know him very, very well over the years. And it might have been like a year or two after that my husband was working for this company. He's like, yeah, you know, you could have negotiated. Like, uh-huh. I gave you that amount because you didn't negotiate. But, you know, in the future, man, negotiate.
Yeah.
So it was a total learning moment for us. Like, wow, even though it seemed like a lot of money for us at that time, there was totally room. We totally could have asked for 5-10, probably more percent more, and yep. we would have gotten it. And so just negotiate. There's no reason not to. You can't really lose anything as long as you go about it, you know, in not a jerky way, right? Where,
right.
You're it's collaborative. It's how can we work together? How can I add value kind of a place.
Well, and that's sort of the really interesting thing about what I do is I say often the biggest reason to negotiate is that there might be room to negotiate. And it sounds so simple, but your story illustrates it perfectly, which is you didn't know it, but you got a great job offer. Yes, it was probably more than you were expecting or your husband was expecting. But what you didn't know is on the other side of that offer was even more money that you could claim by simply just stating a bigger number, right?
Yeah.
And it's not all about money, but you know, if you could be doing exactly the same work day in and day out and be getting a bigger paycheck, why wouldn't you do that? And so that's the biggest reason to negotiate is that there might be room to negotiate. You can't know that unless you do, because you're not going to say, hey, if I were to negotiate this offer, would you give me more money? I mean, they'll go, well, what are you counter offering? You know, then you're into a negotiation. So they're not going to tell you, you know, we're offering you 100,000, but if you negotiate, we're willing to pay up to 120, right? That's not how it works.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
it is interesting. And it seems, well, of course you negotiate and it makes so much, intellectual sense, of course. Yeah. But it's the fear, it's the emotions, it's the yeah, but part of our brain that kind of turns on. So it's kind of, you got to go back to the process that you negotiate, right? And so that's why having like a process and a step-by-step thing can actually turn on that part of our brain more, that problem solving, let's move forward with this, as opposed to that fear talking, that no, don't do this, this is scary. It's sort of like silencing that.
Yeah.
So yeah, negotiate essentially is number two. That the
yeah.
number two mistake is people not negotiating at all, even after they've invested in doing it. That hesitance, that fear, or whatever you want to call it, is so big that even after investing to do it, they're like, no, really. But yeah, do it. That's a great way of illustrating how much resistance there might be to that. So that was number two, and then number three was essentially the way that I was hearing it, Josh, was, okay, I sent this counteroffer via email, and then they just basically don't do anything after that, where it was basically, okay, we talked about an amount. Okay, I want to take some time to think about it and talk with my family about it. And then you send that counteroffer email, and then you get that email that says, let's hop on a phone call to discuss this. And then they kind of just stop there.
Yeah, so there's... The biggest gain is usually in the actual counteroffer. But beyond that, so people will also often ask, so when can I negotiate more vacation or a signing bonus or more stock options or whatever? This is that time. So once you sent the counter, kind of my rule of thumb here is if they reply with a yes to whatever you said, then you're done. And so that tells me a couple things. One is that you should make sure that whatever you're saying in your counteroffer or your negotiation later on, that if they say yes to it, you're going to be happy. The reason is that the way that you're negotiating is you want to make sure that they know that there's an end in sight for them. And so if you say, I would like a 110, and they say, okay. And then you go, and now they're going to be skeptical, because they're going to be like, well, I said yes to the last one. You kept asking for stuff. How many things are you going to ask me for? Uh-huh. And so when I work with people, I like to use a phrase that is, you know, if you can do X, then I'm on board. And you're signaling to them, if you acquiesce, if you give me what I ask for, I will stop asking you for stuff and we will be finished. So my rule of thumb is, once you've counteroffered, then you want to prepare for, okay, well, what if they come back midway between my original offer and the counteroffer that I made? What am I going to say? And so you'll find that it sounds kind of overwhelming, but there's a finite world there, which is, you know, like I keep using the numbers 100 and 110. So they offered 100, you countered at 110. In between are basically 101 to 109. So what are you going to say if they come back to you at 108 or 104? And you want to have a plan for that, which might be you ask for more money. So if they come up from 100 to 104, there's probably a little bit more room there. You could ask for maybe 106 or 107 or 108. But if they say no to that, so my rule of thumb is if they say yes, you're done. If they say no, you ask for your next most important thing, which is usually vacation time or a signing bonus or something. If they say yes to that, you're done. If they say no or give you a partial yes, you ask for the next thing on your list. And you do that like two or three times, always letting them know, if you say yes to this, I'm on board, I'm done. And so that's the way that you can get maybe a little bit more salary. You might be able to get another week of vacation, a signing bonus, more stock options or equity, that kind of thing. So there's often more there. So you've gotten a better salary by countering, but you may also be able to do even better, you know, as you know, you get to the tail end of that process, which again happens in like a 3-minute phone call. It happens very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could see lots of potential mistakes here. So number one, not really having that plan for if they come back with this number, if they come back with this number, like really saying it needs to be deciding for yourself beforehand, it needs to be this amount or else it's, or else we're still negotiating, right? If they say this amount, then it's a yes. And sort of preparing for that, and that you totally can, because you're talking numbers at this point, right? So you know what ballpark you're working in. So right. One mistake would be not having the plan, but then another mistake I would see could be essentially stopping negotiating, right? So if it was like, how would it go? So let's say they offered 100, you then in your counteroffer over email said, you know, how about 110? And then that was like your number. It needs to be at least 110. And then they come back and they'd be like, well, we can't do that, but we can do 105. Whereas, you know, it could be like, well, all right, I'll do 105 if you add in an extra week of vacation time or something like that. But what the mistake might be to just say, oh, okay, 105, let's do it.
Yes,
when
exactly.
You had decided beforehand that no, that's not good enough. And
that's right.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm following you here. But that's hard though, because in a 3-minute conversation, it's really an emotionally charged, fear-driven, OMG kind of conversation. Having that plan beforehand, it sounds so, so super important.
Well, it's funny, you know, you mentioned stories about that, that I actually wrote my own story about this in my book, which is, so I have a specific format that I use for a script, which again, if you look at it, you'll say, oh yeah, an engineer made the script. So I have a way to kind of create a script that you can use that's pretty easy to follow in the conversation. And when I first kind of created the, you know, version, you know, 0.1 of the script, it was on my whiteboard here in my office. And I had it written out on the whiteboard. I had rehearsed it. I knew I had this call coming up with a recruiter. This is like the first time that I had done like a full salary negotiation where I had, you know, starting to actually use the process I wrote about later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I encountered, and they came back and they said, we can't do your counter, but we can do this number. And I almost said, I said half of the sentence. Okay, well, I was wondering, you know, what other levers might be available for us. For example, vacation is what I was going to say. And I got to other lever and I looked at my whiteboard and saw that the script said, no, you ask for this salary number now. So I said, wait, stop, forget I said that. And the recruiter kind of chuckled. I said, if you can do this number, I'm on board. And she said, I think we could probably do that. Let me go talk to finance. And I think that was like a $3,500 jump in my salary or something.
Yeah.
And so I was literally, you know, half a sentence away from asking for more vacation, which I, to this day, I don't know if they could have even given to me anyway. Uh-huh. And I stopped myself and made another $3,500 because I had a script, a plan, but also because I literally had it written in front of my face on a whiteboard so I could see it in front of me while I had the conversation.
Yeah.
So like you said, there's so much adrenaline. There's so much going on. Even if you think you have a perfect plan, if you don't write it down and look at it during that call, because it's so fast, there's a very good chance you'll make a mistake and just, you know, miss something, leave something out there that you could have gotten.
Yeah. And it's also a perfect illustration, your story, of you can even screw it up a little bit, it would still get it right, right? You know, because it's like there is a human on the other end of the line, most likely a human that you may be working with, or at least is advocating for you. And so they'll be okay with a little bit of, oh, you know, I didn't mean to say that. Hang on a second. I need to think about it. Sure, go ahead. Take 5 seconds, you know, whatever you need. That remember that, you know, that goes back to that. It's not like you're fighting them, you know, it's like you're in this together. And they're used to this, and they're used to guiding people through this process. And if they know you have this process, right, and that you're still coming off as human and not a robot, but it's like, you know what, this is what I'm asking for, they'll actually probably appreciate it even more. It's like, hey, I like this person. This person is great. This person is super decisive. They follow the process. I love it. And I'm gonna recommend it. So it's win-win, really, to have this process. And it's almost like a program, right? Like if this, then that. If this, then that. And you might have, like, it sounds like maybe even 5 or 10 of them. So like you're looking through and it's right in front of you during this conversation. What did I tell past self? Hey, past self, what did I say I was going to do when that adrenaline is pumping? So then you don't, you say what you held yourself to, as opposed to just blurting something out that you may end up regretting later.
Yeah. And I think, you know, future self and past self is something I think about a lot. We didn't talk about this, but there's a thing I call the minimum acceptable salary, or your walk away number is maybe a more colloquial way to say it. But it's basically, you know, what is the minimum that I have to take this job? And it's the same thing where I say, before you get the offer, you need to have that number literally written down on a note card or a post-it note or something in front of you, so you can say, this is the salary that I must get to take this job for these reasons, because I have to relocate, or because I would be taking, you know, I would be getting a raise in 6 months if I stay where I am, or whatever those reasons are. It's the same kind of thing where it's so much easier to make these decisions objectively. It's so much easier to create a script objectively and then just refer to it later and just trust that your past self, who is objective and not currently on a phone call with a recruiter with adrenaline, you know, going crazy, that you can say, I trust whatever I did before, and I'm just going to stick to that. So I don't, you know, try and make decisions on the fly and most likely make a mistake because I'm so nervous.
All right, Josh. So it's been super fun geeking out about negotiation processes and systems and programs and algorithms. We're almost up on time. I do have one more question for you. We're going to shift gears just a little bit. And this is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests. And it is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Yeah, that's a tough one. What comes to mind when you ask that is, kind of a couple of things. One is that people are people. So we've talked about this quite a bit, and we've even, you know, the last few things we've discussed were basically related to this, which is that people are unpredictable. They have different levels of adrenaline at any given time. They have different levels of preparedness. They have good days and bad days. And so, you know, it's challenging with my clients to sometimes get them to dial in and to buy into the process and to say, listen, this is what we're doing as we work together. You have to trust me. And there's also the wild card on the other side, which is hiring managers and recruiters who, for the most part, follow a process, but sometimes they have a bad day, or, you know, sometimes they're out of the office for a week and you get shunted off to another recruiter that you've never met before. And now you're negotiating with this new person. And so I think those are the biggest challenges, kind of adjusting on the fly to personalities and different characteristics and traits that different humans have. As much as I'd like to build a beautiful algorithm or a process that works every single time in exactly the same way that's predictable, it's just not possible because of the wild card of, well, if I had caught Frank on a Tuesday, it would have been much easier to negotiate with him. But I caught him on a Thursday and, you know, he was having trouble booking his rental car for his vacation. He was frustrated at the moment and it was harder, you know. So I think that's the biggest one, is just the different foibles that people have and the way that they react under stress and how their lives change day to day. Means that even if I've planned and got a lot of experience and I'm able to coach people up, curveballs will always appear that we didn't anticipate. And so you have to constantly be adjusting to those curveballs and different personalities and things like that come at you. And that's probably the biggest people-related challenge that I experience day to day.
I think you might have mentioned there was two. I think you might have said there was one or two, but
I was thinking one, but from two sides. One is from, you know, my clients in the way that they react under pressure and the unknowns and their world of their universe of information. And then the other side is, even when I'm able to coach my clients or they read my book or whatever it is, and they have a plan, they're still dealing with recruiters and hiring managers who are, again, you know, maybe having a bad week, or, you know, they're on vacation, so you're dealing with a new person. So it's, they have to still deal with people on the other side of the negotiation that are sometimes unpredictable and have different objectives or agendas or stresses. And so that makes it challenging. So it's kind of one thing with, you know, two sides of that coin.
Yeah. That totally makes sense that, yeah, people have foibles, and we can't, as much as we can create algorithms and systems to deal with the people stuff and the negotiation stuff. And in your case, that, look, we're not magicians, you know, that whole walking on water thing. I'm still working on it, but
great at it either. If you figure it out, maybe shoot me an email. We'll write a book about that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll do another podcast on that. Cool. So like I said, Josh, it's been super awesome talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing. And again, I encourage everyone to go check out fearlesssalarynegotiation.com for just, algorithms and systems and step-by-step processes for all of the stuff that we talked about. And then some. You're going to learn a ton about negotiations, some stuff that you didn't even realize you didn't know. So thank you so much, Josh, for such a great conversation today.
Oh, sure, Jen. It was really fun for me, too. And thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Great. Take care.